You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
This is The Space Show.
This is planet Earth. You're looking at planet Earth. Bop, 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 bop. This is planet Earth.
Welcome to Season 4 of our Planet Earth series, in which we look at how space technology is helping us understand our home planet. This is Episode 46. Now, Pam Malroy is a Deputy Administrator of NASA Headquarters, a former astronaut, and she has had these comments to make about NASA's Earth System Observatory.
Our changing climate is creating an existential threat to all of us, crew members of Spaceship Earth. And NASA is uniquely positioned through our Earth Science Program to contribute to one of the first key priorities of NASA, understanding climate change. This year, with our international partners, we initiate the Earth System Observatory, a series of Earth-observing satellites that will measure key parameters to improve the world's understanding of climate change. As we have measured Earth in the past, we've discovered that the most important thing to quantify is not just water or weather, soil moisture, or any individual thing, but actually to study Earth as a system. And so NASA's work here in the Earth System Observatory is critical for the entire planet. And we will initiate the Earth Information Center, an effort to bring together our space-based climate data, along with data from our interagency and international partners, into one place. This will help make it more accessible to scientists, yes, but we really intend to make it more accessible to decision makers, and also all citizens, especially in our communities that are most affected by climate change.
On Friday last week, China launched a pair of satellites to be used for geographic mapping, land resource surveys, and science experiments. Called Tianhui 6A and Tianhui 6B, they were placed into orbit by a Long March 4C carrier rocket from the Taiyuan Satellite Launch Center, which is in northern China in the Shaanxi province.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
On July the 1st last year, a Boeing 747 rolled down the runway at the Mojave Air and Spaceport and climbed into the skies above California. What was unusual was that this Boeing 747 was owned by the Virgin Orbit Company, and slung under its wing was a Virgin Orbit Launcher 1 rocket. The rocket was released and it thrust into orbit. Once there, seven satellites were released. One of them was the Compact Total Irradiance Monitor CubeSat for NASA. It took a month and a half to commission the spacecraft and its instruments, which has eight detectors to measure the radiation coming from the sun. Now, the CTIM instrument employs an entirely different design from that used in earlier satellites. Previous satellites suffered from ultraviolet-induced degradation of their detectors. The new detectors use a carbon nanotube optical absorber. The total solar irradiance measurements are needed to calculate the energy balance of the Earth.
Hello, my name is Rafa Muljewski, and I'm the CEO of ICEI. ICEI is the first commercial organization to have launched a synthetic aperture radar satellite that weighs less than 100 kilograms. We currently operate a constellation of 14 of those satellites, being able to image any place around the globe, regardless of weather condition or time of day, within just a few hours. We use the data collected from that constellation to help us solve problems of everyday life. Most notably, we are focused on natural catastrophes. 2021 has been an amazing year for ICEI. we have launched 7 additional satellites to complete our constellation. We have become the world's first company operating a daily coherent change detection product, which further improves the capabilities of the data that we collect. More importantly, we have used the data and the infrastructure in space to tackle the problems that are so important to us on Earth. Those problems are mainly natural catastrophes. We have observed over 300 floods during 2021 and the end of 2020. That information has been always shared with the governments and people on the ground to help them react to the floods better. It is, of course, important to mention that the cooperation between ISA and European Space Agency has been cornerstone for both companies. We have worked this year on 2 critical programs. ESA has brought ISA's data into a third-party mission program earlier in 2021. That has allowed the scientists and workers within public organizations to access ISA's data for free and use it in order to improve the models that we all use and to solve problems related to natural catastrophes and others. Later this year, we have joined Copernicus Contributing Mission Program as the first new space company that has been allowed to do that. Through that program, ESA will use ISA's data and share it with the institutions and customers around Europe that take advantage of the Copernicus Contributing Mission Program. This is a huge milestone both for ISA as well as for all the users, as now the company has a very important anchor customer. At ISA, we strongly agree and believe in ESA's theory and thesis for the world. We think and we know that space is really the way to answer the problems of today. And the urgency to act, the time to act, is really right now. At ISA, we are looking forward to all the collaborations with ESA. We would like to humbly thank all the people involved in the collaboration and express our appreciation for their work. There would have not been a strong ISA without a strong ESA. We are looking forward to all the future collaborations to build stronger Europe in space. Thank you very much.
The same SpaceX Falcon 9 that launched Australia's Skycraft satellites on January the 3rd also orbited 3 more of the Finnish ICEYE satellites, adding to those previously placed in space.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
In late November of 2021, NASA announced the cancellation of its Geocarb mission. Now, Geocarb was to have been a satellite to provide new measurements of the natural sources and exchange processes that control carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and methane in the atmosphere over the Americas. At the time of cancellation, Geocarb was projected to cost over $600 million. This was more than 3 times the initial cost at the time of selection. That was $171 million. Not only was Geocarb way above cost, it was far behind schedule. This was having a detrimental impact on NASA's other Earth science missions. Since the Geocarb mission was approved, however, newer options to make key greenhouse measurements are emerging. So NASA now intends to obtain greenhouse gas measurements using instruments aboard the International Space Station and from international and commercial partners. Now, Kat Faber writes music about science fiction and fantasy subjects, but she also does some factual material as well. And this song, called Axial Tilt, is about the spin axis of the Earth and how its tilt causes the seasons. This is Kat Faber, a song recorded in 2011.
Earth spins on its axis, that makes day and night, but its axis of rotation isn't fully upright when looked at in relation to our orbital plane. So each hemisphere in turn's receding more solar gain. is the reason for the season. Axial tilt is the factor in play. Summer will run while we turn to the sun, and winter when our hemisphere is pointed away. As our axial tilt puts the sun at its height, we get more sunbeams per acre and more hours of light. As our orbit swings round the other side of the sun, the angled light is weaker and midday sooner done. Axial tilt is the reason for the season. Axial tilt is the factor in play. Summer will run while we turn to the sun, and winter when our hemisphere is pointed away. We can't see the tilt that makes the seasons go by, except by the migration of the sun in the sky. Toward the horizon, winter shifted its track, and the ancients threw a party when it turned to come back. Axial tilt is the reason for the season. Axial tilt is the factor in play. Summer will run while we turn to the sun, and winter when our hemisphere is pointed away. And just like the ancients from whom we descend, we're glad to be reminded that the winter will end. Taking our customs from pagans of old, we have ourselves a holiday defying the cold. Axial tilt is the reason for the season. Axial tilt is the factor in play. Summer will run while we turn to the sun, and winter when our hemisphere is pointed away. Axial tilt is the reason for the season. Axial tilt is the factor in play. Summer will run while we turn to the sun, and winter when our hemisphere is pointed away. Winter when our hemisphere is pointed away.
Now, one thing that can change our planet's axial tilt is the movement of mass around our planet. For example, melting ice sheets just send water from the poles towards the equator. The GRACE follow-on satellites have had their fourth anniversary in space, and the Science Operations and Instrument System performance has been stable. Both the microwave and laser ranging between the two satellites have been continuously and successfully operated in parallel. The laser ranging instrument can measure the distance between the satellites down to nanometer scales, which is 30 times more accurate than the microwave instruments. The mission science data teams have provided 30 monthly global maps that tracks Earth's dynamic surface mass movement. Now, these movements include ice melt in the Greenland and Antarctica, as well as land water storage changes. This is pretty amazing what you can detect by measuring the Earth's gravitational field to high precision.
Planet Earth is blue.
You have probably heard on the news that New Zealand had a massive cyclone, and it struck the North Island of New Zealand, particularly the East Coast, and caused a whole lot of what New Zealanders call slips, but which Americans call landslides. Thomas Stanley is from the University's Space Research Association, which is in Maryland, and he had this description of how his organization is defining what landslide hazards are and how software is being used to monitor them. This is Thomas Stanley.
Disaster management can be described as following a cycle, and landslides are no exception. Often, the cycle is described with three components: preparedness, response, and recovery. United States Geological Survey defines a landslide as a wide variety of processes that result in the downward and outward movement of slope-forming materials, including rock, soil, artificial fill, or a combination of these. The materials may move by falling, toppling, sliding, spreading, or flowing. Landslides can also be called landslips or mass movements. In this talk, we're focusing on landslides triggered by rainfall. However, global estimates of landslide hazard and exposure are available from the pager system at the USGS website. Globally, landslides cause thousands of casualties and billions of dollars of damage every year. The exposure of individual countries varies widely, but recent research suggests that the populations of some small island nations are among the most frequently exposed to landslide hazard in the world. This can be attributed to multiple factors, both human and natural. Fortunately, there are some tools that can help us understand landslide hazard before a rainstorm occurs. If preventive measures are taken early enough, some disaster damage can be mitigated. Another resource available at Landslide Viewer is the Global Landslide Susceptibility Map, which shows the areas that are more prone to landslides. To make it, we combined data on slope, faults, geology, forest loss, and road networks with a heuristic fuzzy approach. Then we used the GLC and other landslide inventories to check the resulting spatial pattern. Landslide hazard is the presence of a mass movement that might or might not be dangerous depending on where it is. Landslide exposure is the presence of humans, animals, infrastructure, or other assets that are at the same place and time as the landslide. The Global Landslide Nowcast shows where and when landslides are most probable in nearly real time. It relies on rainfall data from the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission, as well as some other factors that contribute to landslide hazard. You can get estimates of the potential impacts from landslides in every county around the world by viewing the exposure layer. You can click on a specific administrative district to see the fraction of the population and road network that could be impacted by landslides. By now, you may have wondered, how do we know where landslides are probable? The answer is that we use the Landslide Hazard Assessment for Situational Awareness Model, or LASA for short. LASA 1.1 takes the form of a heuristic decision tree with two steps. In step one, it takes in rainfall estimates from the last 7 days, from the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission, or GPM for short, compares them to historical precipitation, and determines whether the rain is heavy enough that landslides are possible. The rainfall estimates come from the GPM Core Observatory, several other satellites via a level 3 product called iMERGE. The iMERGE algorithm produces a globally consistent view of precipitation with a tenth of a degree half-hourly resolution. In 2020, we used the Global Landslide Catalog to train a machine learning model of landslide occurrence, but we supplemented it with several other landslide inventories, including those mapped from optical satellite imagery. Instead of relying on a single susceptibility map to estimate the effects of factors other than rainfall, the model takes in several variables separately. These include slope angles derived from the Shuttle Radar Topography Mission and the distance to active faults shown in the GEM database.
And that was Thomas Stanley of the University's Space Research Association, which is in Maryland. This is The Space Show.
88.3 Southern FM.
Planet Earth is blue.
In December last year, the space show had other program commitments, so didn't give an important NASA Earth observation mission the attention it deserved. This evening, we begin to redress that deficit. To Vandenberg Space Force Base on the evening of December the 16th, where, lit by arc lights, the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket is about to lift off.
This launch will mark the 100th first mission of NASA's Launch Services Program based at Kennedy Space Center.
15 seconds.
Here we go.
10.
9. 8. 7. 6. 5. 4. 3. 2. 1. Engine ignition and liftoff. Liftoff of SWAT, our first global survey of Earth's surface water to study how this ever-changing resource affects our climate. Now we're feeling it inside here in the Mission Director Center, the rumble all around us from launch.
Absolutely. And now you're getting a good look at the onboard camera looking down towards the aft end of the rockets, and you can see the Merlin engines coming to life there.
And this room coming to life, really. Lots of rumble going on in here. And we're soon going to hear that the rocket is supersonic, meaning it's going faster than the speed of sound, followed by Falcon 9 reaching what's called max Q, the moment of peak mechanic stress on the rocket.
Daydreaming of a trip to the lake? SWAT focuses on the planet's most precious resource, water. The Surface Water and Ocean Topography Mission will help researchers compile the first global survey of Earth's surface freshwater and study our changing ocean and coasts. It will use a new radar instrument to measure the elevation of water in major lakes, rivers, and wetlands, as well as the ocean. SWAT's water height data helps track regional sea level changes, observe small-scale ocean currents and eddies, monitor coastal processes, and assess water resources on land. With a warming climate, an inventory of Earth's freshwater storage, and an understanding of sea level rise's effects on coastal communities is essential in order to help decision makers manage their water resources and plan for hazardous events.
Cedric David is a supervisor of the Water and Ecosystems Group at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. He is also a hydrologist, and he had this description of what SWAT will do.
So now, you know, as far as what do? I am a hydrologist, which means I study the Earth's water cycle. And specifically, I like to look at rivers, but also other things like lakes and reservoirs. So overall surface waters. I spent some time simulating how water moves down river systems throughout the world, a mix of equations and observations, whether it be from observations on the ground or observations from space.
Why is surface water important?
I think that's a great place to start. And perhaps we should state the obvious first, Brian. So water is essential to life. And as a matter of fact, when NASA looks for life, in other worlds, one of the first things that we look for is the presence of water or the potential for water. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, water is also essential for us on Earth, for humans, but also for ecosystems. So the first thing that you notice is that this is the blue planet, right? And of course, it's blue because we have lots of water. And that makes our planet very special compared to other places in the universe. Now, the blue planet also has a lot of white. And the white turns out to be water as well, whether it be clouds or ice caps. In this particular case, the ice caps in Antarctica here in the southern pole. And so lots of water, blue water and white water. Now, if you take all of the water of the Earth, water in the oceans, in lakes, reservoirs, groundwater, water in people, in trees, in animals, and you put it all in a big sphere, you know, it might seem when you look, we have tons of water, but when you put it all together, maybe not as much as we might have thought. But the vast majority of it is salty. That makes it kind of not great when you try to drink it. And it's not perfect if you try to irrigate crops either. So another way to look at it is if you take away all the oceans and seas and you take away another notable portion, which is frozen water, same thing, not the best to drink. Now, this is liquid fresh water. So not the salty, just fresh water and not frozen, all liquid. So a little smaller of a bubble. And now the vast majority of this little bubble is actually groundwater. Now, groundwater is great because it helps us in times of needs. You know, if it gets pretty dry, in case of a drought, it is a nice source of water, but you do have to go pump it. So you got to go extract it from the ground, and that takes effort and energy. The other inconvenience with the groundwater is that it takes hundreds of years to replenish. So that means when you take it away, then it's likely not going to come back anytime soon. And we've seen from a variety of other NASA satellites that basically groundwater has been depleting around the world. And so you can think of groundwater as a savings account for water. And we've been withdrawing quite a bit from the savings account, which can be concerning. The water in Earth's rivers, lakes, and reservoirs is the most renewable and the most accessible source of fresh water. And so that also, because these two together, it makes it the most sustainable source of fresh water. And this tiny dot is also special for us humans, because most of the ancient human civilizations were born in great river valleys. And so, you know, the proximity to this easily accessible and renewable source of fresh water has been an important factor in basically the birth of humanity. But so one thing to remember here is that, you know, that's basically all the water we got. All right. And it might change from, you know, one bubble to the next, depending on the evolution of the water cycle. But that's all we got. And another thing that I think is important to look at is how many people we are. So yeah, this is a chart that shows the variation of the growth of human population starting 10,000 before Common Era to now. There's a big rise in population, right? We started with basically nobody, and it's been rising very quickly up to now. So for reference, in 1800, it was just about a billion human beings on Earth. And right now in 2021, almost 7 billion human beings on Earth, almost 8 billion, actually over 7 billion. So that's billion with a B. And so we only have this much water, and the human population has been growing very rapidly. And so what this tells you is that the amount of water per person has been decreasing, which can be concerning. Now there is another portion of the story, and if rivers don't care about political boundaries, right? So rivers flow across national borders, and water is also a shared resource. All right? And a river basin is basically an area where if it rains there, the surface water is only going to stay within this this polygon, and it will flow eventually all the way downstream to the nearby ocean. Surface water is a shared resource. And what's important to recognize is that, of course, water is vital for everyone. Now, if you're lucky and you happen to be living upstream of one of these river basins, basically you have first dibs on the water. All right. So, you know, that's great. Lucky you. And water is vital for you. I get it. But if you happen to be living downstream of a river basin and perhaps somebody else grabbed it before you had access to it, then it could become a problem. So, you know, water is vital. It's a sensitive resource because it's shared across nations. And again, there is only so much of it. So an old adage is you can't manage what you don't measure, right? And so we have to manage this precious resource. All right, so this is how we've been measuring surface waters around the Earth. Basically, you put a stick in the water or maybe a ruler, and you measure how high the water is. if you add to that little knowledge of how deep the water body is, the shape of the bottom of the water body, what we call bathymetry, and some physical equations of hydraulics, then you are able to determine how much water you have and perhaps even how fast water is flowing, which is, it's pretty great. So, you know, the old school way is to use a ruler. A more modern way is to use a radar, perhaps mounted on a bridge just above a water body. And then the radar will shoot a radar signal straight down, and the and that signal bounces on the water, comes back, and by measuring the distance between the radar and if, by measuring the time that it takes for the signal to come back, we know how high the water is. And that little antenna that is at the top allows you to share the data on the internet. So that's pretty cool. Now, there's a problem there. So this is a map of where river gauges, so like the ones that we just discussed, are located around the world. And so all the dots here, whether they're dark or light blue, are a place where at some point there was a gauge, a river gauge in the world's rivers and lakes. Now, first thing you notice is that in some places there just never has been one. Okay, so that could be an issue. The other thing to note here is that those river, those gauges that are light blue basically have not been accessible. Data has not been accessible since the year 2000, either because the people taking the measurements are not sharing them or because they're just not paying for the measurement at all. And those gauges, which are darker blue, are gauges that are still available past the year 2000. And so what basically, what we're learning from this map is that river gauges are disappearing. So let me summarize the whole story for you. We only have this much water. And then we have so many more people than we've had in history, and that's growing and growing. Surface water is a very precious resource that is shared across nations. And now we're realizing that the measurements that we're that we need to manage, to properly manage the precious resource, are going away. And that is a problem.
That was Cedric David from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and more about the SWAT mission on next week's The Space Show.
Southern FM.